Hi everyone, my name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. The other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. We could really use the help. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything, too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Before we get started here, though, I want to tell you about our new monthly guidebook / workbook called The Motivated Musician. It's geared towards serious musicians, and it offers challenges, exercises, professional advice, and more to help keep your career and your musical life on track. Also, as an extra perk, members get exclusive discounts from MyMusicMasterclass.com. So if you want to learn more, go to MyMusicMasterclass.com and you'll see the subscribe link in the menu. Click that and you'll be good to go. All right, so today we are super lucky to have Peter Bernstein with us, and I've known Peter for a while, and he's a good dude and a cool guy, and we used to live pretty close to each other uptown, and I think one time we even saw each other on the subway bringing both of our cats to the vet or something very strange. Anyway,
big memory of that. Exactly. Yeah, big memory of that.
Anyway, if you don't know Peter, which you probably do, he's played with a ton of people. Lou Donaldson, he had a really great trio and still has a great trio with Larry Goldings and Bill Stewart. He's played with Diana Krall, Sonny Rollins, George Coleman, Etta Jones, and a ton of other people. But we're super happy to have you here, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You know, good as I can be. Happy to be here and happy to be anywhere, really.
Have you been watching, first of all, I know you're a Yankee fan like me.
Boo.
I'm going to let you down because I haven't seen a baseball game in a long time. I think since I had kids, I haven't had the time to even watch like a full top and bottom of an inning. It just takes like, it's like 45 minutes, right, to get 6 outs. So I don't know. I just haven't. I love it when I first, you know, when springtime comes and you see it on TV and it's like, oh yeah, baseball's back. But I can't say I've really followed the Yankees. I could not tell you anybody in their lineup except this dude. Aaron Judge. I've heard about him.
Right.
But that's it. You know.
Well, man, it was great hanging. Maybe we'll see you next time.
I mean, if you want to talk about like Willie Randolph. If you want to talk about Reggie? Chris Chambliss, Willie Randolph. I remember those cats.
Thurman
Mickey
Munson.
Rivers. Thurman. I remember hearing about him passing away in 1979. Yeah. Like, I was a kid. I was 12, but I remember that. That's when I was a Yankee fan, you know.
Throughout,
I remember when Willie Randolph came in to play second base after Sandy Alomar retired or got, you know, like, Willie Randolph was the rookie. I remember that. So that's Oscar Gamble. Those are the Yankees I remember, you know.
All right, well,
so
let's.
I'm out of touch.
All right, we're gonna pivot because I'm so angry. Let's
sorry.
So, no, you're a New Yorker through and through. You were
That's for sure.
In Manhattan.
Not a Mets fan, I'll give you that.
No.
That right. Helps at all.
Yeah.
No, I was born and raised on the Upper West Side.
So you've been there quite some time, and you know, since then. And let's talk about New York right now. Like during COVID, you know, I can tell you we're in Westchester now. You know, I'm obviously from the area. You know, I grew up in Jersey and lived in New York for many years and still do.
Yeah.
But it's different here. I'm just curious about what's going on in New York City right now. Like, what's the vibe and like what's going down?
Well, New York is pretty strange. I mean, it's weird. For a couple of months there, it was completely deserted. Nobody was on the street. People were hunkering down. It was the, you know, 3 months ago was the height of, you know, the nightmare here with like, just unbelievable death and tragedy and just like, you know, we're living through a nightmare. Then we kind of, New York came through the worst of it and things started to fall apart a lot of other places in the country. But New York is kind of, I wouldn't say coming back, but the streets are not empty anymore. And where I live, 4 years ago, we were lucky enough to get into Westbeth,
the
artist housing place down in the West Village. So West Village is, you know, except for the crazy artists that live in Westbeth and all the crazy village characters, West Village is like super rich. And so a lot of stores were closing before COVID hit. Like Bleecker Street was like one out of every three storefronts was, you know, abandoned because I think the rents were super high.
People
couldn't have like a store that, you know, one of those stores that had like, it seemed like it had like 12 dresses in it, you know what I mean? And pay whatever, $15,000 a month rent and survive. So those kind of places were, there was a store on Hudson Street that it was called the Monocle Store.
Wow.
They sold monocles.
Yeah, that's going to be tough. Yeah.
Belts, ties, and monocles. Like, yeah. I don't know anyone that wears uses a monocle. So how could you have a whole store that's like, these are the kind of luxury item stores that were actually starting to tank because nobody buys stuff in stores anymore. And, you know, the nine people that wear monocles will probably just order them online and they get to. So the village was already going through this weird kind of thing. And this is not any kind of urban blight. This is almost like the urban blight of like ridiculously wealthy Bleecker Street, you know, ridiculous rents. So it was already starting to be a weird kind of feeling like, how is this going to be sustained? Like, what's the future of this neighborhood in 5-10 years before the pandemic, which just like wiped out a lot of stuff? But now there are restaurants that were like small little places that now have expanded. They have like 50 seats outside the street. They seem to like, and people are out on the street and people are dining and people are on the street. There's, you know, I live right on the West Side Highway and it's crowded now.
Yeah.
You know, there's traffic. There's like trucks and things seem to be back to life. But as a our world of music is still completely dormant. Just streaming gigs and things like that. Teaching online.
Mm-hmm.
That's the life now. So it's just like not.
It's going to take a while, man.
It's going to take a while. It could be another, who knows? I mean, it's weird to predict. Sometimes I feel we're still in like remember after a horrible, 9/11 and there was all this panic and all this stuff. And then there was the anthrax thing that came on the heels of that horrible attack. And people were like, anthrax is the, and then, ended up being like, people were sending some anthrax around, but it was also like just the fever of panic and of like, what's the next thing? Like, are they still coming? Are they still coming after us?
Remember when the power went out? That was like a year after, and right away everyone jumped to it. And
that's true.
I had a walk
PTSD from that.
Totally.
Yeah, I remember.
I walked like 40 blocks up to my place. No, actually more than that. I walked from 14th Street up to 125th. Yikes!
Damn.
I was in better shape then.
It's a weird thing, and now like. I mean, there's all these articles going around. New York is dead forever and all this stuff. Like, I don't buy it. I think New York will be back. It might change a lot. Maybe the corporate kind of thing that was helping to kind of, in a lot of people's eyes, bring New York down into becoming a, the family businesses, the small businesses, those were really on the way out. And, I don't know. It might be that those can come back before the corporate stuff will come back again. So maybe it's like Bloomberg's New York, the New York that he was kind of like, let's bring all these corporate people into New York. And maybe that is dead forever. But that, now it's not so simple. It's not just like, oh, the corporate people are gone. Now they'll be like, 25 jazz clubs. It's not that simple. No. It's like, and with that. Who knows? I mean, it could become it's already becoming a more dangerous place. But I don't know. I'm really curious about what's going to happen and what is next. Like, how will it rebuild? It definitely will rebuild. I mean, it's still here. It's not like it's not Dresden, in World War II. It's not like it's a wasteland. Yeah. Everything is still here, but it's just like things aren't moving the way they were. And, Spike from Smalls put up a thing on Facebook about all the, in every direction looking at Smalls, the once thriving, of course, that was 7th Avenue. And that was like, his place was full basically seven nights a week. and now it can't even open. And obviously the neighborhood is decimated. But almost half of the businesses were already out before of that, before the pandemic hit. So I think it's a little bit more like it was in need of some kind of rebuilding, rebirth already. You know,
right.
The difference is there's no tourists now. So that's why that neighborhood is dead.
Right.
That's why 7th Avenue, that's why all the clubs are gone. And if the tourists don't come back, the clubs won't come back.
I mean, tourists will come back, but it might take a while. Like we were talking about 9/11. I mean, we were both in New York at that time. And that was a one-day thing, which was a terrible tragedy. But it took people, I felt it took at least a year for people to like come to, for the numbers to come back. I remember being at Smoke and them being like wanting to cut pay because no one was coming in, you know?
Right. And that was such a different thing too, because while that cataclysmic event happened, everyone that kind of looked around and was still, you know, was still alive, which was, we could all come together and hug each other. Whereas this is like, dealing with this has been the opposite of that. Now it's like a whole different social dynamic of how people greet each other. And, you know, I'm just trying to, my way of being positive to people that I recognize from my building in the neighborhood is to be like, hey, nice mask, man. Beautiful. Looking good. You know, like that's a way to kind of like, you know, and everybody's doing the elbow, you know, thing. If someone you're really close to, like you just hold elbows a little bit longer before you release the elbow lock. You know, it's just like a whole different dynamic of how humans interact. And that could be, I mean, and I'm thinking about young people that are going to come up with that. They'll have never known, like, how people used to hug each other. And, you know, like, that's
some weird
crazy
shit. Yeah.
But at the same time, people survive and they find ways to express their affection to each other and they find ways to come back. It's just so different from 9/11 in that respect that was, like you say, one day. And then, of course, the anthrax craze after that, or you know, the weeks and months.
But
after
it still
that
had a major impact.
All kinds
impact.
Of crazy shit.
Yeah, major.
Major
impact.
But it wasn't like, it wasn't like you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could still go places and go into places and inhabit space with people, and it brought people closer in a lot of ways. Whereas this, dealing with it in a responsible way, means you have to like, you know.
Isolate
your mask, you know.
Yeah, but what's crazy
it's terrible.
Is like most other countries deal with this stuff. Like we're just not used to anything bad ever. Like if you talk to people that go to Israel a lot, they're just like, yeah, there was like sirens, there was bomb warnings. I went out for a drink anyway, you know, like they know how to just manage in a weird world.
It's crazy.
Well, I mean, of course, there's people, you know, our age or whatever, or you know, roughly our age that grew up in Romania and remember a revolution there and remember, you know, all kinds of,
it's
and
crazy.
This is, you know, 5 years ago, they, you know, there was revolutions, there's just wars all over the world. And we're not used to having our way of life disrupted. That's definitely true.
Yeah. I did this episode with an Alexander Technique teacher. Her name was Masana Nazarian. She's super cool. And she lives in Australia now, but she's from Iran. And in the podcast, she was talking about as a kid, you know, there was a revolution in Iran and there were bombs dropping. And she didn't even know she had this PTSD until later in life when she started doing things like Alexander Technique and yoga and trying to chill out. And and she said that she had to get over the fact that a bomb was going to drop. You know what I mean? Like in her back of her mind, she just, even if she wasn't thinking about it, she was just kind of had that nervous energy. She's like, all right, relax.
Right.
A bomb's not going to drop right now. But, you know, so everyone has a different experience for sure. I mean, that's a whole different, you know, that's a whole different can of worms.
Now it's like we wait for champions kind of that have money. They want to take a chance and they see some of this as an opportunity. Like maybe a lot of people see New York right now as an open market. And like want to go and rebuild, you know, that's what I wait for. Like I love those types of people because that usually turns out pretty awesome, but we'll see, you know?
So Pete, what are you doing in terms of, I know that you play Smoke and Smalls. Have you been doing those gigs at the clubs and they've been live streaming them?
I've done a couple of small. That was the first time out in early June. I did one of those streams from Smalls.
I saw that one. Yeah, it was cool.
With Ed Sherry. Yeah, that, and Spike was just, he got this, he was able to get somehow some work out his thing where he had a foundation and he was now nonprofit and he was able to get, well, actually Billy Joel came through and gave a big donation to like fund the first month of gigs.
Yeah.
So he was just like, I'm going to use a foundation. I'm going to have the streaming for free like it always was. He was ahead of the game with the whole streaming idea that goes back 10 years now. But he was like, well, you had June 3rd to play. You were supposed to play at Mesro. You still want the date, you know? And I'm like, well, I'm definitely free. You know, like nothing else came in. You know, the gig was never canceled. I just assumed that it was. So everybody that was booked in June, either at Smalls or Mesro, I think he was just able to work it out for people if they wanted to and were able to do the gig. So I've done a couple of those, and I did one last weekend from Smoke. Paul Stash just has been in the last couple of months just trying to get the stuff in the club to do that. And he's basically saying he's like, he's starting a new business because he's just trying to feel his way around with that.
So Paul got a whole live stream rig too?
He's got a, it's actually really good sound. Nice. He's got a real engineer, this great cat, Tyler McDermott, okay, doing sound. And he's got someone to do the video and they have like cameras and split screen stuff, and it's like, you know, Small still has, I think they upgraded it, like they like moved one of the cameras around or something like that, but Smalls is still pretty low key in terms of like every 10
production
seconds
value.
The shot changes and they have their microphones and it's just, you know, a little more homespun. But Paul was like, I'm gonna spend some money and I'm gonna charge tickets, you know, I'm gonna sell the tickets.
I don't doubt it. Paul's like, he goes all in when on stuff like that.
He's humble in that he's like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just trying to, I know that people that play here to varying degrees have people that would come and listen to them, except they live in London or they live somewhere else in the world.
It's so not a bad
why
idea.
Not tap into that? Whereas people aren't going to be able to get up to 106th Street on Broadway on any given night. And he only needed about 60 people in that to pack that place. But now he can, you know, so I think he had like a couple of hundred people. He's averaging, you know, it's just getting better as the word gets out about the Smoke live stream. But it's a different thing, and because people paying for it, there's so much free stuff on the internet. You don't want to hear some music. You want to hear music. You can go to YouTube and watch it. Endless hours of free stuff. So to get people to pay for it, I think is a little bit of a different thing. And
for sure. But you know,
so
that's
the
game. That's
that out.
That's the game that, you know, we all have to work in the digital media world. Is how to do something unique enough or special enough or...
Exactly.
You know, there's incentives that you just have to figure it out.
Before, he was trying to get people to come to the place and spend, you know, $90 on like, you know, dinner and
booze.
A couple glasses of wine and cover charge instead of, you know, instead of not, you know. So, I mean, it's just a new world.
It's a new game.
Which I'm hoping doesn't become the only way for a while. I mean, I think people will... need the thing. I mean, it's okay, and this fact that the sound is good and you can plug in your headphones and listen to it and it's kind of cool, but I think it's still going to be, people are still going to want to go hear live music and be in the room where the vibrations are being created and look where they want to look instead of where the camera is telling them to look, you know, television,
absolutely,
wide world of sports style, and just, you know, just be in a place. So I think, you know, that will come back eventually. The question is, what kind of venues are going to be able to still be around, and how much are we going to be used to? I mean, the danger is like the new generation coming up. They're all right here in their phones all the time anyway. Yeah. So that's the thing is like trying to get people away from that and show them that a live experience is different.
Yeah,
but that can also be a respark. And blow their minds. And
I think so.
You know what I mean?
Well, that's what Smalls was before all this, was like young people going in like, wow, it's pretty cool in here. You know, you get a drink and you just watch the people and it's like you can feel it. And it's like it's not just about your experience through your headphones. It's about experiencing it with somebody else in a place. It's like where people come together to be part of a human interaction. Like it was already becoming – with the technological, overkill and incredible technology of, it was already becoming a novelty kind of thing to just like be in a room where people play music. So,
but man, once you feel that, you can't unfeel that. Like I saw a YouTube thing of you with Yotam playing a tune, and it was great. But all I could think of was, fuck, I wish I was in that room. What the hell, you know? Because I know what that feeling is.
That bar next door, right?
I think so.
We played their duo a couple times, and Yotam had his camera like on the bar, probably next to the ice machine, so it's like you could look where you want, and when you're there and kind of get a different spot if you but yeah, you're right. It's just like it's not the same. It's not the same as being there.
So what are you doing right now, like in quarantine, musically? What are you practicing? Guitar? Is there anything specific? Maybe some piano writing? Are you utilizing this time?
I've been doing some writing. I did some writing, and I got a chance to make a recording thanks to Paul Stash and his label. He was able to get into Sear Sound. Sear Sound was reopening, and they were doing some safe distancing recording sessions with relatively small ensembles where everybody could be. So he gave me a date, and it was like, I guess about exactly 2 months ago now, end of June, we went into the studio, and I had some tunes I hadn't recorded before, and some that were just written in the last couple of months that were brand new. And so I was able to make a recording, which I was very relieved to do, pretty much because I'm so not about like, hey, I'm going live on Facebook my technology. Like I just was able to do something through GarageBand where I played along with, a singer, bass and drums, Sasha Dobson, Neil Miner, and Charles, Charles Ruggiero.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. Charles started it out. Like he got Neil to do it and then he played.
Charles is really into that. He's great. He's great. Yeah, I did one of those.
They did a couple choruses of this nice tune and then Sasha sang over it and they were like, can you just put some chorus? I was like, this is kind of cool. It was like, but it was the first time, and Charles had to walk me through the whole garage. I'm embarrassed to say, another old person kind of moment, but he walked me through GarageBand and how to do it. And I tried like 4 or 5 takes. It's hard to actually play when you're actually the recording engineer too, and you have to film yourself too. Like I have to make sure the camera was in the right spot and the microphone was like, it was a headache. It's like, it's so much the luxury of going to a recording studio. And everybody else sets up the shit and you just play. It's like, this is great. It's so much easier than doing it all yourself. But at the same time, I'm realizing when you have control of it and you can do it, you can create your own world of music. And this is how a lot of people have been doing it for a long time now, like just creating their own recordings from nothing, just layering, sounds on top of each other. So that was one experience, but it was my first time doing that. I want to get deeper into GarageBand just as a kind of a composing tool or whatever. But what I've been doing is practicing and trying to write and trying to, keep connected to the instrument. It just feels strange because the few times I played those few little stream gigs, the recording session, which was brutal because it was like, 5 hour date, And none of us had played for like 5 hours. We had done the set at Smalls is one set.
Yeah.
You go in there, you play, it's just like, oh, I can,
plus, like,
I guess it's over.
Plus the kids
it's
don't have school anymore. You know what I mean? So it's like,
well, that's the thing too.
And so it's not like you have those breaks to practice as much.
No, it's been hard to find time to practice and also, what to do with it. I mean, I've been working on trying to practice with the idea that I will play with people again. So the idea is like, how do I get better at the things that I want to get, that I always wanted to get better at, playing melodies, improvising, comping, I'm trying to believe that comping isn't going to be just a completely like, outdated thing that people do anymore. Like if you play live with people, you can comp, you can respond and relate and interact with them. So I've been trying to practice kind of playing solo guitar, but with the idea that I want to get better at soloing and comping at the same time, but there's no one to, kind of
right.
There's no one to volley with. So you're basically like playing tennis against a wall. You know, you can work on your shot, but what's coming back at you isn't the same. You know, it's still just hitting the wall and coming back. So what I've just
it's like
been trying
playing
to practice.
Pong against the computer.
Exactly. But I've been trying to, you know, play solo guitar in a different way, where I'm just like trying to work on how I would play the melody of the song or whatever it is, and improvise and comp for myself. So instead of it, solo guitar being like a speech or a monologue or a soliloquy of some kind, it's really like I'm going to do a conversation and just be both parts,
that's
you
cool.
know, and try to do that and get, you know, obviously if you're comping for yourself, you're only going to comp when you're actually not soloing, which mm-hmm. is kind of, I was trying to get into that concept with comping before. Like if you're playing behind, you're comping for a really good soloist, they don't need you to lay out the chords. They know it's what the progression is. They know it's 2-5-1 or whatever's happening, and they don't need you to lay it down. Really what you do is you punctuate when they stop playing. Mm-hmm. I would watch Herbie Hancock like comp, and he'd watch the horn player. When the horn comes out of their mouth, that's when he jumps in and plays something. So the idea of like kind of trying to do that for myself, playing an idea, then finding a way to punctuate it and answer it, is going to give me a different approach when I only have to do the comping part and mm-hmm. just wait for a space. And now conversely, the soloing part would be like, be a better soloist by leaving more space for someone to respond to you. Don't be one of those soloists that, you know, because they practice so much, and that's the danger now if you just practice all the time, is that you just play your shit. You're just like, I'm having a conversation, but I'm basically running down my stuff mm-hmm. to someone who's alive and listening to me, yep. as opposed to really having a conversation. And that's hard, you know,
yeah,
because
hard.
We're so alone with our thoughts when we get into that practice mode that it's about what I'm doing. So I'm trying to practice soloing with the idea of like, I got to comp for myself, which means I have to shut up sometimes,
right.
and give myself a chance to respond. So I'm trying to really just practice those things and practice playing solo guitar with that in mind of like getting better at you know, serving and returning.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, just both things. But I don't know if, I mean, I don't know what the results are. I'm not sure it sounds any, you know,
you have to wait
like
until
anything.
Another human can play with you.
Well,
I guess.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm trying to think about how do I practice by myself mm-hmm. in isolation to make myself stronger at the different musical tasks that I've always been working on.
You know, if you get better at GarageBand, you can record a bunch of takes yeah. of you comping and then play over them and different and just record like 10 different tracks of it and then
yeah.
see if you can randomly, I don't know, but still not going to be two people listening
yeah.
to, you know, it's still the
right,
comping
that's the
person
thing.
Isn't listening to you live,
yeah.
unfortunately.
I mean, that's how I used to practice in the old days when technology was like yeah. a cassette recorder.
Yeah.
You know, like
make
I
your own
Ebersols.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'd never play with Ebersols because mm-hmm. I always said, man, I got to comp a few choruses first.
Yeah.
And that way I could work on like specific, you know, I'll do two choruses of these changes and then I'll do two. But I had all these cassettes filled with like, you know, I'd hear the metronome and then I'd come in with some chorus. I'm like, oh, what is that? Okay. Oh, yeah, that's... That Star Eyes, okay, I'll practice that. And then I would just like, you know.
Nice.
So now I'm kind of getting into that a little bit now, but just with, you can't buy blank tapes anymore, so, and you can't find a cassette recorder. So the technology has improved, you know, but.
So you were talking about social media before. You said you weren't that involved and you didn't have Instagram and things like that. Do you post anything about yourself playing or mostly just promoting gigs and just talking shop and just hanging out? Do you use it as a promotional tool, basically?
Mostly. Like when I have, every time I mean, before this, and when I had a gig, I really felt like the least I could do was, you know, for somebody that gave me a gig, the least I could do was let people know about it. I remember
right.
back in the day, maybe you're not quite enough to remember about like going around putting up flyers.
I remember.
When you had a gig, you know?
At Manhattan like, School Music, where you'd put them on the rehearsal room doors and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know. That was the least you could do back then, and that was a pain in the ass, you know. So
yeah.
this is much easier to make, you know. But I have done very little in terms of like setting up and just playing and putting it like or going live or something like that. I just haven't been feeling that extroverted or
right.
you know, like I wanna you know. I did do one thing. I wrote a composition back in April. And I just was able to, my Wurlitzer was working pretty well. Kind of, now a couple notes are sticking and it's kind of a drag, but my Wurlitzer was sounding pretty good then. So I just like was worked out this tune, and I was just like in some kind of effort to just like, set it free. It sounds kind of pretentious, but I just like, let me just record, make a little iPhone movie of, 3 minutes of me playing this tune. Right. And I put it up there, and I was surprised that, so many people like actually checked it out or whatever. So, and I was encouraged to do more. But then, as I said, like, I just don't feel that same thing about like with the guitar, like here's me playing at this. I don't know. I was more like with the guitar. Well, and I think I don't, if I'm just playing my composition, it's like no one expects me to be playing the piano that well. So I didn't feel any pressure, right. But if I'm playing the guitar, I feel like it would have to be, I go through the same kind of, angst as a recording session or and then you're playing for no one. You don't get any kind of immediate response. Right. And I kind of felt like if I get kind of caught up in like playing and then, waiting for some kind of, I haven't felt it, and I haven't, as I wrote some more tunes, I was like, I should put this tune up, and then I'm like trying to play it on my keyboard, and like two notes are sticking, and it sounds like crap, because I just had a, I found that one, whatever, maybe it was the weather or something, but the no keys were sticking on the Wurlitzer, and just sounded okay. So I'm like, this just sounds decent, I'll record it, and I put it out there, but that was it. I just kind of haven't followed up with it with playing the guitar and being demonstrative that way. Like I always felt like with gigging and performing, like I need to feel like I'm going someplace to play for people. Like I don't get the same feeling of like I just want to, I need to perform for somebody. Right. Like even if there's no one there, I just need to perform. I don't feel that way. I'd rather practice and get into something. But I've been lucky that I've been working a fair amount over the last years that I get that satisfied thing of it goes out and you feel something back.
That's kind of the most important thing, yeah.
And the fun of performing was playing with other people, right. And like kind of doing that. So I just haven't been that much of a
right.
poster and in that respect. And like with Instagram, I know like that's the real way people kind of communicate these days. So
yeah, and it's just boring, to be honest. Man,
it is
social media is boring. I was born in 82.
Right.
So I was on the tail end of like the real world.
right.
And then when this stuff started happening with like AOL, it was amazing. But that was because like I was home after school,
mm-hmm.
And I'd talk to my friends. But the way that it just spiraled into now, that is what life is. I'm just bored. Like I'm so sick of it. I'd want to go do something else, So I mean,
yeah, well,
the experience that you've had in life, dude, I'd be very confused if you were into this stuff and you were like sitting there posting stuff all day. I'd be like, wow, that's crazy. You've experienced too much.
And older, it's an outlet for them. And I kind of, if it's satisfying for them, then I've good. That's good for them. I'm glad they're being, something's being, part is being fulfilled, especially now because we don't have interaction.
Yeah.
It's the only way, I mean, something like this, like Zoom or this kind of thing, it's the only time you see somebody without a mask.
I know.
Yep.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like.
I know. It's crazy.
It's weird.
We were talking about this a little bit before we started the podcast, but don't you think that social media can be a bit mm-hmm. dangerous for certain people? I mean, if you say the wrong thing, you could be canceled. You could not work again in the industry. Most people are respectful and do the right thing, but others just get drunk and say something crazy, and it's not a good thing, right?
Well, it's there forever. Mm-hmm. As opposed to if you get drunk at a bar, the people that are in the bar hear you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they know what kind of asshole you are or whatever.
Yeah, but they have
nobody,
to say
it.
Yeah.
But what I found also is that, like, just observing Facebook, it's like everybody is exactly kind of how they are, but just on Facebook.
Yeah.
So that's dangerous.
It is dangerous. But even post, I don't want to say post pandemic because we're definitely in it, but since that hit, everyone kind of responds to it in total keeping with their personality in a way. And it's like interesting to see that like whatever technology comes along, people are still themselves. I think
for better or
worse.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah. Obviously, like what you say is that someone could have a loose tongue in certain respects, and then get into some trouble
or just
like,
be drunk
in a group setting, and then maybe have to be told by some people, "Hey, man, you really shouldn't say that." But it's the people that were involved in that conversation,
right.
And you can learn from that as opposed to, like you say, being canceled because someone took a screenshot of your comment and then it never goes away.
Yeah, or it's just going viral. That's the thing. It's like if you make a post, like you said, you say something in a bar, you might have 10 or 12 people hate you. But like they can tell other people what you said, but you didn't really say it to those people. But if you say something and then all of a sudden you have a million or whatever, in the jazz scene, you don't need a million. You need about 300.
Right, exactly. That's
But there's also something to be said for being slugged, man. Like you say something stupid to someone, they hit you. Then you learn.
That's old school.
Like, that's old school, but it's like without any sort of...
There's no repercussion.
Like that'll never happen on the internet. So it's like you just do whatever the hell you want. It's like that's worse.
It's a mask of anonymity, but it's not really a true anonymity.
Yeah, you can't just like put ice on it, and eventually you know it'll heal. It's like it's out there forever, and that's a scary. You know, it's still the reality of what you said, and the context which you say it in, your intention. I mean, the thing is, the problem with just comments and things like that is they can just be taken out of a context. It's just a comment.
Yeah, anything can be.
Whereas you didn't see the previous, 74 comments in the same thread that like got someone riled up enough to say what they,
Sometimes they're worse.
It's the thing. I don't know. I mean, I think it's, whether you live in a village that's just like, 50 people, or you live in the, our world of social media, which is infinite, the same, adage applies of just like, don't be an asshole.
Yeah, exactly.
What I mean? Like that's, it's just like, it's still true whether you're going to have to see those same 49 other people that you live with, or it's just like reverberates way past, echoes into infinity.
That's also sage career advice. And it's kind of the way you've conducted yourself. Like I've known you for a long time and, like not many people. I actually know none, but I'm just going to say not many because there's got to be someone who thinks you're an asshole, right? I mean, everyone has someone. Probably not. I mean, honestly, you're always been a really nice guy and very approachable. I know other guitarists that have been fans of yours and you're easy to talk to even for people that don't know you. No, but you've always been good with people, and I know that, you're obviously a very, very talented musician, and you get a lot of work, and rightfully so. But if you were a dick, it would be harder, don't you think? Hopefully.
If I was a dick. I mean, I try not to be a dick. I mean, I do have people like say that, "Oh, you're humble." I'm like, I'm not humble. I'd listen to Bird and Bud Powell and like Coltrane and Stravinsky and B.B. King. Like, that's what I listen to, so I don't think I'm humble. I just, I suck compared, I can just really and some nights I really don't play well at all. And some nights I'm playing stuff that's like, I'm trying for stuff I can't play. And other nights I'm not trying for stuff at all. So I found myself like on both sides of like, man, I'm not stepping out enough, I'm not stretching, I'm not going for it enough. And then I've also been on the other side of it, whereas I was going for stuff, and why? Just kind of try to play some stuff that sounds good. Like I'll err on, and that's the thing about playing, not every night, but playing a fair amount, is that you start to find your balance of how much to push and how much to, I don't want to say stay in your lane, because that implies a lack of creativity. But I always feel like with improvising is involved, like there's a balance of clarity and spontaneity. You want to be clear, but you also want to be spontaneous. You don't want to be spontaneous at the expense of being clear, because then people are like, "What? What did you say? What is that? That's unintelligible." Yeah. But if you go for clarity at the expense of spontaneity, people say, "Yeah, I already heard that solo 12 times before. Yeah. You know what I mean? So you have to find the balance of, and that's just a creative challenge that everybody has to meet within, which is part of musical, but it's also part of just how you go through the world. How on edge do you want to be? How comfortable are you with yourself? And how comfortable are you with taking chances? How comfortable are you with not maybe saying the first thing that comes to your mind, not going through the motions as a human, you know, and just trying to think about being in this moment. And that, you know, can mean like when you're talking to somebody, you know, talk to them, you know, don't just be a person. Here I am, me talking to somebody, you know, like yeah, kind of feel like that. That's like, you know, dickish, but you could actually be that way and have that veneer of friendliness. That's, you know what I mean? People won't know that you're not really in the moment. So I just think that, I mean, it's a long way around of saying that playing music should help you become a better human being, especially if you're dealing with improvisatory yeah. nature of music, of like, mm-hmm. just because it was cool last night, it's like, all right, let's go out and do that same show again tonight, fellas. That's not going to cut it, because what was the moment last night is now not this moment. Right. Everyone has lived 24 hours more and dealt with whatever, you know, good or bad they've dealt with in the these past 24 hours, and we're in a different place.
The audience could be different. The vibe could be different. Sound could be different.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't play the same set again necessarily, because the tunes that worked in that order last night, maybe you're not, it doesn't feel right. So it's just always about, and the greatest leaders I've played for have always found a way to like find that balance between like doing their thing, hitting their marks as it were, but also being aware of the immediacy of the moment. So I don't know. I think just like, I mean, a great way to learn how to be a better human is to play music, because you're so exposed in that respect. Because, you know, playing it safe is not cool, but also, you know, flying off the rails, it's almost irresponsible if you're playing with people. They don't want to play with someone who's not being coherent and cohesive and clear. So you're always trying to deal with those balances and that kind of those poles so I don't know. I mean, I don't know how I got to there, but from your question, but I'm sure there's, you know, I've worked, had regardless. To work on some, you know, some personality things, not that, you know, I had, but just being more even with people, more honest, more, you know, and when you fail on the front of being honest or being a real person, it's usually based on some kind of insecurity you have. So as I've tried to learn how to be more secure as a human, that's the challenge. Be secure as a human and be in the moment, and then I don't know, that's a kind of some recipe for you're less likely to be an asshole, because you're not consumed with whatever struggles you're dealing with, you know. And I just, when I'm out and playing music with people, I feel gratitude. I feel, you know, fortunate to be there, fortunate to have a gig, fortunate that, like, wow, people are actually here to listen to us play. Like, that's,
I think that the permeates too, you know, I mean, that comes into your playing. If you really believe that, I think that's apparent, you know what I mean?
Man, I never took it for granted. I always, starting out, like getting as a young guy playing with older cats like Lou Donaldson and Lonnie Smith and people like that, I was always like, wow, this is incredible. I feel so happy, and you know, but at the same time, like, you know, I was young and I was like, you know, I didn't take it for granted, but I think I took it for granted less and less as I got older, thinking like, wow, you know, these people, like, we can get on an airplane and fly someplace, and then we get to this little place and they give us a place to stay, and then we go to the gig and there's a, you know, there's an amp there for me, and there's like, you know, whatever, you stand here or you go there, and there's audience, people come into the place and they pay money and they do whatever they eat or drink or whatever they do, or just sit there and listen. It's a freaking miracle. Like, it's a miracle. And I've been feeling that more and more till, you know, right up until it all kind of stopped. Like, man, what a great thing. So it's kind of like the part of the day where you, whatever's hanging you up or whatever you're going through, you can kind of just let go of that and just be like, man, this is a nice thing that's happening right now. I get to play my instrument. And if I can just put away all the stuff, like, I'm not this enough for these group of people who want to hear this, or I'm not that enough for these people who want to hear that, and just be like, man, I got this thing, and it's made of wood, and I can hold it, and then there's the the metal things, what do you call them, strings. Yeah, I get to put my fingers on those and like, I, you know, like just enjoy holding it. Just enjoy making one note, making the thing, you're making something vibrate. You know, that's a heavy thing. You know, just like if you were hitting some gong and just like, boom, you know, you just feel that, wow, I did that. I struck this and I made this vibrate. That's, if you can not get any more complicated than that, of course, you know, if you're playing a form, you want to stay on the form or whatever you want to deal with musically. Right. It's not as easy as just hitting a gong. Try to hit it in this area, you know, between, you know, like, but again, if you're a serious gong player, then that becomes its own, you know.
Yeah, there's got to be more to
don't
it.
Just,
yeah.
Yeah, I
don't, we're not belittling gong players here.
Yeah, know. No, but it's just like, but just the, I just use it as an example of like, just the easiest way to make a huge thing vibrate and make a massive sound, you know? But that's what an instrument is. You try to make sound. And if you can get with that and not get overthinking of like, I'm not modern enough, or I'm not traditional enough, or I'm not this, and all these little things that kind of make you like
they creep into your head,
a mess.
Yeah.
Then it's easy to just be open and just enjoy the experience. You know, that's cool. You like the way so and so, you know, vibrates the instrument. That's cool. That's great. That's good. I like that's fine.
Yeah, man.
You know, but just not get into this kind of ego thing. And I don't know. That's where it is for me. You know. That's why this solitary thing is difficult, because I don't know, it's just all you.
Yeah.
You know, it's all you,
it's
and
not
you
natural.
And just kinda, to me it's not, you know, I don't know.
No, I mean, it's not, not for, I think most people would agree.
You know, I feel the gratitude of just being able to have a nice instrument and play it, but to play it for people is another dimension, you know. It's a social thing, you know, and playing with people is social, and that's like how you grow,
man.
You know?
This is a good question for you, because you know I've had the pleasure of, you know, hanging and talking to a lot of older legendary musicians, and I always get these amazing insights. And sometimes it's a word, and sometimes it's a story. And you've had these great gigs, you know, with Lonnie for years, and you know, Dr. Lonnie Smith. You know, for those of you know, he's great, and he's also just a great showman, and he's a great performer.
Incredible.
And you know, you played with Sonny and Diana Krall, and you know, Diana Krall isn't obviously the same age as them, but you know, George Coleman would be up there, Louis Hayes, and how has this affected you? I mean, how did it affect you when you were younger, just getting this kind of experience, and what lessons do you stand out? I mean, I know that's kind of broad, but I mean, you know, there's so much wisdom with those cats.
Yeah. Well, what I don't know. I mean, what I observed, especially early on, like being able to play with Lou Donaldson and Lonnie Smith together, like what a pair,
heavy.
You know, because they're so different, you know, and such, like, yet that the love they had for each other and just the way they related was so beautiful.
Was Idris on that?
And then we played at the Vanguard a week with Idris, which was incredible.
That's like all the cats.
That was all the cats. So the thing in my head, you know, was hard to get out of my head that during those moments was like, God, George Benson in 1967 with his beautiful big guild guitar playing the most perfect shit on that record, Alligator Boogaloo. And, you know, and of course, Lou, you always talk about Grant Green all the time, and Idris and Grant. It was just the thing about just Lou and Lonnie, like how disparate they were as characters, and even in their musical language too, you know, but how well it worked. And just as personalities, like just to kind of be in between them, like Lou would play, and then tradition, you know, the kind of the format was guitar after Lou, and then Lonnie. So every night I'd just be like, it's Lou, and then after me is Lonnie. But what happens when I'm playing? Like, what is what's that? Like, how do those, like those guys were just so completely themselves, every tune, every night, every chorus, every, like, there was never a moment where there seemed to be any doubt in their mind who they were. Whereas I was a young guy, you know, barely 30, not even 30 when I, you know, And I was just like trying to figure out, still checking out the records, like what's the right shit to do here and what's the right, you know, how do I justify being here? Because I know there's a lot of cats that would love to do it, you know, and I was definitely one of them. But, you know, I was lucky enough to be in that situation but felt like I had such a, at the foot of the mountain of self-realization. Like, what am I? You know, I'm just this guy trying to play with these old guys. Mm-hmm. So that was the lesson of how completely themselves they were all the time. Almost like, you know, they were just natural beings, just natural. Like, they were in their natural habitat playing their instruments in a club for people. Like, no self-consciousness, no, you know what I mean? So that was the lesson for me to see. And they were patient with me, and they were encouraging in many ways. And if I wasn't playing the right stuff, sometimes Lou would be like, you got to do this or you got to do, you know. But very little instruction, because I don't think they really, maybe they learned over the years that the more you tell a guy what to do, the more confused he's going to get and the more self-conscious he's going to get. So you just do your thing and let him fall in and figure it out, and he's going to have some nights better or worse than others. And that was what it was. I mean, and so I was just super lucky. And then years later, I was playing, got to play in Sonny Rollins' band. And we were doing what I thought was going to be a rehearsal before we had a little string of gigs. But it actually was going to be, was like a drummer audition, because the drummer, the regular guy in the group, there was a couple gigs he couldn't make. So they wanted to try out to some other guys to see who would be the sub. So basically what it was like a few drummers coming in for 40 minutes to play and try out some different tunes. And I felt for these cats because they were nervous. They all know about Sonny and drummers. Yeah. And, you know, like there's a famous interview with Sonny where the guy asks him, like, why did you change rhythm sections so often? And Sonny says, because sometimes one set is enough.
Oh,
you know, Jesus. It's like really, you know, and the drummers that he's fired is like a list of the greatest drummers. Yeah. You know, of all time.
Exactly.
But so I was feeling for these guys, and there was this one guy that came in who ended up, you know, doing a couple of gigs as a sub, and we were doing this calypso, and it wasn't really grooving, and Sonny was, you know, not happy. He was trying to tell the guy, you know, but he wasn't, you know, what he was saying, I was kind of like, I'm glad he's not saying that to me, because I wouldn't really know how to respond to what, like, do this, more of this. Like, it's not, you know, you could just tell it wasn't happening, but he wasn't really sure how to tell the guy to, like, what to tell him to make it happening. So anyway, we kept playing it and kind of just, you know, it was getting more and more tense. And then finally it kind of turned the corner and started to, maybe they changed the tempo or something, or, you know, Cranshaw was there just totally supportive, right, all the time, you know, positive vibe, smiling, playing beautiful notes in the right time. And it just kind of, maybe the guy just kind of relaxed into it or whatever, but it started to feel good. And Sonny's, you know, after he kind of stopped, it's like, yeah, 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 that's it. That's it. That's what I'm talking about. That feels good. And the drummer was just like so relieved, you know, besides, you know, he was relieved, then elated, you know, but first he was just relieved. And then in his desire to like really give Sonny what he wanted, and, you know, he was reverent of Sonny, as we all were, I mean, but he was like, so, Mr. Rollins, on this kind of calypso, would the snare drum be open or closed? Like, what's the right way? Like, it's a valid question, yeah, for, you know, authentic calypso or whatever. And he asked that question, and Sonny just looked at him for, you know, kind of thought about it. It must have been like 15, 20 seconds, which was a long time of silence when stuff was starting to finally feel good. I was just like, it kind of heard like a, oh no, record scratch, you know, kind of sound of like, oh boy, you know, he asked a question, and then you could tell that the guy wasn't sure. He kind of regretted asking the question because of 20 seconds of silence was like a long time. And then Sonny said, I'll never forget this, because it actually changed my whole perspective of life as a musician for me. He said, you know, if the music feels right, you can do what you want. You know, he says, you're here to make decisions. And if you think about it, you couldn't be in a more privileged position. And I remember that. Those were the verbatim, the words he used, because it just echoed in my head. If you think about it, like, think about the fact that you're here to make decisions.
Yeah.
I mean, Sonny wasn't a calypso band. Sonny didn't really care if the snare, you know, you could, it could be open, it could be closed, it could be both. You could do whatever, you know.
You wanted someone to make a decision and make it feel good.
Exactly. Yeah. If you're serving the music, if you're playing unselfishly, if you're playing to make the music feel good, it's always right.
Yeah.
And you're here to make decisions, and also you're here to understand your privilege being in that situation. Like, that was the thing. It's like, I've always been like, man, what does Sonny want? I got to try to, you know, Jim Hall, you know, you think like, that's the way to comfort Sonny. Yeah. I mean, from those records, not that we were playing the same kind of music.
No, but those are iconic records, you know.
Yeah, you couldn't get away from it. And that was kind of how I was able to get in that situation, you know.
Did you study with him at the New School, at Jim?
I did. Yeah, why, I got to study with Jim. And that's another elder. Someone else I met at the New School was Jimmy Cobb. And that, you know, someone I got to play with
for sure,
you know, many, many years. Yeah. And that was...
Those were great gigs.
Incredible. Yeah. Amazing experience of just watching somebody just sit down their instrument and just...
It just sound and just have that feel, you know, and that sound.
Yeah. And the instrument disappears. You know, it's just like, it's just them, you know. But those words from Sonny, I never forgot it, because it was just like... And he went on to say something like, you know, there's symphonies full of great musicians who have to read the music in front of them, follow the conductor... And they're lucky to have those jobs, because that's in their world, that's the highest level you can get to. But our world is like, you're supposed to think about what you should do and then do it, which you know, of course, with that freedom comes responsibility. It's like Spider-Man, with great power, you know, comes responsibility. So you have to know so much about forms. You have to know so much about how to make the music feel right, about, you know, what's appropriate. But then beyond just being appropriate, it's not, he's not looking for someone just to be in that, just sit in that chair. We need someone to sit in that chair and play these notes. The point is to make the chair your own, you know, and like,
and add to it.
That was what, that's what improvising is about. It's like being, confronting the reality of like, man, I could play what I want. And so then you say, well, what is it that I want to play? Do I want to play what I feel like I'm expected to play and should play, or can I get beyond that into the level of maybe like what I noticed in Lou and Lonnie and Jimmy Cobb and Jim Hall and all the people that I got to see, Harold Mayburn, George Coleman, like all the people that I got to see, that just there's no self-consciousness, and they're humble around music. I mean, I used to see Harold and George Coleman talk about chord changes all through the break.
Right.
The whole break, they'd be talking about some tune and about chord changes and still into the music. You know, not just like, oh, well, it's just a job. You know, what time we have to go back on. Like, it was like always, you know, but to hear Sonny say it like, you know, you have the privilege of being able to play what you want to play, and you're supposed to have an opinion and make everyone feel like this is the right thing to do right now because of the courage of your conviction. So what this guy, you know, was asking was like, what do I do? And Sonny was just like, you do what you want to do, and if it's not right, I'll tell you. But if it is right, it's right. You know, you don't need me to tell you that it's... Right. That, so it was just like another thing of like...
And Miles would have said the same thing. You know, I mean, a lot of those guys, don't you think?
I'm sure. I mean, it was an unspoken thing, and maybe that's why Sonny took 20 seconds to even, you know, wind up with an answer. He's like, you know, you're here to make decisions. This is why you're here.
Yeah.
You know?
That's heavy.
And
man.
So with that and decisions, I mean, that's goes beyond music. That's life. That's decisions, you know? So it becomes overwhelming, you know, because... Sometimes the more music you know, or the more things you think you should be doing, you're torn between like, well, what's the decision? What am I? Who expects me to be this? Who expects me to be that? Who expects me to? Who do I want to be? What they want me to be? You know, like, for whom do I? Yeah. You know, and then, but there's another level, and I started to realize like, this is what makes all these people like so strong, is that strength. Courage of conviction, feeling that, you know, I'm doing what I've decided to do, you know, and that's the thing. So I, you know, just being around people like that, and just the way their humanity was just what their music was about, like Bobby Hutcherson, just being around him on a couple of gigs, and it was just like,
yeah,
he was who, what he played was who he was, and yeah, I mean, there's a lifetime of study of mastering of the elements of music and having an original approach to harmony, rhythm, melody, dynamic, sound, you know, all the things that make that go into it. But at the end of the day, it's like, who are you? You know, that's why teaching is a weird thing for me, because it's like, you know, you're not supposed to like ask people for what they think the answer is. That's why it was so hard for me to do those things for you, like just have something to talk about. Just talk about that for a while. To who? For what? You know, what am I responding to?
This is an existential crisis here.
It was for me. I was
well.
A wreck. I was a wreck for weeks afterwards. No, but it was just like, it's really about context, because I don't feel like I have like any answers. I think any answers, here's this. If you do this, these two triads over this chord, it's like you're selling snake oil. You know what I mean? It doesn't, it's just like,
I kind of want to actually interrupt that for a second and ask, like, you're of a rare breed that has seen the immortals, right? And played with those cats. Is there a sense of more freedom and free will in those guys and girls than there is in the fully like educated intellectual language of modern jazz? And like do you see, can you hear a difference? Can you feel a difference in those two worlds?
Well, I think, yeah, but I think there are still a lot of incredible players coming up now. Yeah. And I think there were a lot of cats back then that, you know what I mean? That were just like, oh, this, I'll play the latest licks. But the latest licks were, you know, Coleman Hawkins. Yep. Or when Bird came along, everyone tried to play like Bird. But that's, you know what I mean? Like, not everyone could play like Bird, of course. But I think the whole institutionalizing and the kind of the, you know, teaching of jazz has had some kind of effect of, yeah, codifying the music. And now there's like these scales that everyone's kind of, you know, that if you just play these scales. But I mean, I don't think there was, I mean, older guys talk about scales.
Yeah.
But they don't, I remember being at the New School and having a lesson with Jackie Byard. And I was like struggling with half diminished chords, this song Woody and You. I'm like, yep. Mr. Byard, I really want to just play, because he didn't teach many non-pianists. With his pianist, he had a whole bunch of pianistic things. He's like, what do you want to do? Why are you here? You know, you know, his hair everywhere. He was like such a character. He was just incredible genius. Absolutely. And the whole history of the music, modern to like, yeah, he was all about, you know.
He's badass.
Fats Waller. I mean, just unbelievable history of the music. But I was like, Mr. Byard, can we play Woody and You? You know, I really want to work on this tune. Okay, yeah. So we started playing Woody and You. And I'm like, I'm having trouble with... He's like, you got to use your scales. You know, yeah. That was like the last thing I expected him to say, because hearing him on records with, you know, Eric Dolphy and Booker Little and those incredible records, like, it doesn't sound like he's playing scales. But he's like, hey, Woody and You, you have to diminish. It's a cycle of these. You got to use your scales. I was like, yes. But how? Right. You know, like, use your scales. It's you know, so he was aware of that. And I mean, I think institutionalizing the music just came about as the community kind of dried up. Like, mm-hmm. Now institutions are where the players congregate. Yeah. Whereas to hear the old cats talk, Philadelphia, now there's, well, not now, but even, you know, a couple of years ago, there's one, two clubs. Well, Ortlieb's closed. There's like, now there's one club in Philadelphia. There were like 20 clubs in Philadelphia, yeah, you know. And all these towns, Lou and Lonnie talk about, you'd be on the road. If you wanted to stay out another couple of weeks, you just had to do it a couple of weeks beforehand to stay out, because there was a circuit, yeah, Columbus, Ohio, you know, all these places in upstate New York. There was just a whole circuit of, and you would go and play a week in these places, you know, Buffalo, all these places, that's Cleveland, crazy. You could go, and, you know, so it was like, that was the community. And that was how musicians that traveled met the local musicians, because they were there for 1 week, maybe 2 weeks. So now, how do you meet a guy from Cleveland? Well, you meet at the New School, mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Because nobody goes to Cleveland to play for a week. You might have a night there or something, but it's just like the institutions have kept alive, or been some place for there to be the socialization and community aspect of the music. So with the academic part, with this institution, it's all happening within the walls of a school as opposed to a club. People have to come up with like syllabuses and kind of ways of talking about how to learn to play, which is, you know, has its negative, a negative effect in that, you know, you can go to, I mean, there's kids that go to these so-called jazz schools and they never hear like, you know, like have a real jazz history class where they really check out the short history of the music, you know. The guys that are into that, and they learn it on them on their own now, especially now because there's so many. You can just have every Louis Armstrong. Right. It's all on. It's all out there. You can get it. You can listen to it all. You know, you don't have to have a great jazz history teacher to be hip to Louis Armstrong. You just have to know about it and find it. So it's different, but I still think that there seems to be more guys in this generation that want to swing. And there's a lot of guys that want to play stuff that maybe they think is kind of more modern, but it's still kind of coming out of like whatever ECM, right. Which was already 20 years old when I was in school, or 50, you know, like there was a lot of guys that in the mid 80s when I went to school at William Patterson College that didn't care about playing blues. They just wanted to play, you know, like
straight A stuff,
plug it, especially guitar players, all about the chorus and reverb and stuff. And that was what they were into then. So, are those the good old days? I mean, it didn't seem like it then, you know, if they are. But I met a couple guys that, and those guys met some guys, and, you know, we all kind of found our places in who we wanted to play with and stuff. And hopefully we all kept an open mind. I used to listen to a lot of ECM records, but I kind of fell in with another thing where that wasn't the sound, that wasn't the gigs that I mean, Lou Donaldson and Lyon didn't care about ECM, so I was checking out the records that would help me fit into this musical world as I was before, which is maybe why I was able to be in there in the first place. But I was aware of it all, and I think people are aware of stuff now, and I think a lot of young people just they kind of have a skewed sense of perspective because they're just young. I know I did in a lot of ways, but it's just like you don't see the bigger picture when you're, you know, kind of just into it. And schools have their little pockets of like, and if the stronger players are in a certain stylistic bag, then a lot of, you know, then the other guys go that way. Whereas if the stronger players are about bebop, then, you know what I mean? Like, it's just kind of like, it's a social thing, like any school. Like, it's the same kind of thing. Yeah, the most popular kids go, you know, or wants to be like that or whatever. So there's all kinds of social dynamics that happen that aren't happening inside the more natural and the way the music kind of developed, which was in these nightclubs where people played all the time. And Lonnie was just like, he would say, we would play all night. We would start at 10 and play till 3 and then go somewhere else to play.
Yep. Right.
And now it's like 3 sets. Oh, man. People are like, you know, I'm like that. I'm, you know, Smoke made us play 3 sets. Like, that's a long night, you know. But we just get conditioned. They just play it all night. All for weeks, and it was just like,
yeah, it was the way it was.
Go out on the road, they go out on the road now. 2 weeks is a 2 weeks is a long tour. Back then, you know, 6 weeks was about average, you know, to go on the road.
Yeah.
So it's just like it's changed so much, but the schools are keeping the community there. So
it comes down to the individual. That's everything, and to me, that's like that's hopeful, because I feel like there's a side of students that have a fear of chasing the immortals, right? And like they feel like they're never going to go anywhere. And it's like, if you don't let that go and understand that that's not how they thought, like that they made this shit, you know?
It's also really hard because of YouTube and Facebook and Instagram, and you see all these geniuses and, you know, old or new, you know, doing the craziest shit of all time.
Right.
It's you know, you have to get out of your own head, right?
Absolutely.
Peter, we've talked about a lot, and I don't want to keep you much longer. I know that you have a super busy life, and you have to probably eat dinner.
Well,
or something.
I have
like
a dog
that.
To walk and dishes. That's my life now. Laundry. Exactly. You know, if I can that's get some saying. Practicing that's, in, I'm happy. But because that's the thing about the road. It's like the road is, you know, traveling is much easier in terms of music. Like, you have time to practice. you know, because if you're not traveling all day, then you actually have time alone. You just have one kid, but it multiplies. You have two kids, and it's like never ending laundry, never ending dishes and things, and just like it's cool, it's beautiful, I love it. But I haven't been home for 5 months, like straight. Yeah. Ever. So I'm just like, wow, this is hard work. I mean, like, you give it up to, you know.
It's hard, man.
You're not cycling 2 fives anymore. You're cycling clothes and laundry.
That's right. That's right. That's the cycles I think about now. That's true. That is true.
All right, brother. Right. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Peter.
Man, thanks for having me. This has been fun, man. It's really been fun. Anytime, man. We can talk about any other current events as they pop up.
Just no Yankees, apparently. Yeah. But we'll do that next time.
But is there going to be a season this year? I mean, they're playing, right?
They're playing, yeah.
What's going on, though? I mean...
Hold on, I'll tell you.
Well, the Red Sox are getting killed every time they play, so you guys can at least feel good about that.
They're tied, but... Yeah, I mean, it's 2-2 in the seventh inning against the Rays. Gerrit Cole pitched a good game. There's lots of stuff going on, but this is live, and by the time this airs, all this is going to be just old news.
Right, it'll be
old news.
But I mean, this season is going to happen. All teams are out there.
They are
doing it.
They're playing a shortened season, like a little, and it's weird.
But is the game different?
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
after the ninth inning, if it goes into extras, they put a guy in second base. It's weird, man.
Wow. Just a random person from the audience.
Oh yeah, whoever.
Just bring him out from the crowd. Yeah. But I mean, like, but with social distancing now, does the first baseman, they not hold the guy, or they take like longer leads off first base, so they're at least 6 feet apart at all times, or like, how does that work?
They get tested every day, so they don't really have to do the social distancing thing.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Because the guy, I would think the guy leading off first base just would never go back to first base. Like, if the pitcher, he's just got to go to second.
Yeah. And
because he can't just dive.
There's also nobody in the audience, But it is what it is.
That's right. There's no crowd.
Yeah,
they're just
no
playing
crowd.
So if you can imagine how weird Smalls would be with nobody, how weird is like a stadium?
It's got to be dead quiet and eerie.
Quiet.
They put fake crowd noise in. It's super weird, man. I mean, there's some weird shit going on.
No.
You should watch one just as a social experiment. It's crazy.
Oh my God.
Yeah. This is the world, man.
I wonder if it changes the sound of like the crack of the bat or anything. Like if there's just no.
Dude.
I mean,
it's like Thunderdome around here.
Wow,
some Mad Max stuff.
Unbelievable.
But anyway, on that note, Peter, thanks so much.
I'm gonna get into some baseball. My dad's really into baseball. He's always talking about the Yankees and what's going on. So I got to get into it, man. I got to get into it. I will.
All right, bro.
Edit all this out. But thanks a lot, man.
Thank you, and we will talk.
Good to see you guys.
Later.
All right, man.
Take care.
Thanks, man.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail? You can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformerspathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So, look forward to hearing from you.